I didn't know if it was me or not. We're so glad that you've joined us again. And I don't know if you're tired of the quarantine yet, but my patience is gone. And when I go to town, I think that most everybody else is tired of the quarantine too, because when I pull out of Food City, I can't seem to get on the road because of the traffic. There's a part of me, and I think probably a large part of you, that wants to get out. And yet, having said that, there are people that want to get in. We want to see people. I think most of us want to get out and get around people again. But there are people that want to get away from everyone. And that was true of a man in the Bible named Jeremiah. And he wrote a long, or his thoughts and prophecies are recorded in a long book in the Old Testament. But in one place, he says in Jeremiah 9, verse 2, "Oh, that I had in the wilderness a lodging place for travelers, that I might leave my people and go to them!" Exclamation point. "For they are all adulterers, an assembly of treacherous men and women." Jeremiah was living in a time when God was bringing judgment upon the people of Israel. And in fact, most of the prophets lived in times of judgment. And their job was to go and to proclaim judgment on the people. In Jeremiah's day, the people had turned from God. The priests were perverted. The prophets did not declare the word that God had given to them. The people had turned from the law of God. And in fact, Jeremiah says that they had gone so far as to practice child sacrifices. They were an evil people. Jeremiah is right. They were an adulterous and treacherous folk. And Babylon, the hand of God, God was using the nation of Babylon to bring judgment on them. And it was Jeremiah's job to go through the streets, to go through the towns, and to declare that the people were evil, and if they did not repent, and repent very quickly, that Babylon was coming, and that they would all be destroyed, which in time happened. But the people did not want to hear that. The people did not think they were that bad, and they did not want to hear pessimistic news. And so everywhere Jeremiah went, they insulted him, they abused him, they verbally abused him, they physically assaulted him. And so here in this passage, Jeremiah says, "You know what? I wish I could just leave it all. I wish there was a little cabin somewhere in the wilderness where no one could find me that I could go to." Every now and then on Facebook, people will put these silly memes and say, "Would you give up the internet to spend 30 days in this cabin?" And Jeremiah would have said, "I'd give up food to spend 30 days in a tent where nobody could find me. That's how fed up I am with this situation." And yet Jeremiah stayed day after day in spite of his feeling deep in his heart that he simply wanted to escape. Jeremiah stayed. And I would like to show you, I think, the reasons why he stayed. When everything inside of him says, "I want to get out of this mess. I want to flee. I don't want to be here another second. I wish I could leave and not see any of these people in my life." Yet he stayed. And I want to give you four anchors that kept Jeremiah where he was. Four ropes that tethered him to his situation. Four reasons why, in spite of everything inside of him wanting to flee, Jeremiah stayed where God wanted him to be. I think the first reason Jeremiah stayed, and the first reason why God is calling on some of you to stay right where you're at, is that he had a strong sense of duty in his life. Jeremiah would look at his situation, and he had to ask the question, if I don't do what I'm doing, who is going to do what I'm doing? And you say, well, anybody could have been a prophet. All they had to do was hear the word of the Lord and go out and courageously say what God had told them to say. But Ezekiel was a contemporary of Jeremiah. He lived during this time. And in Ezekiel chapter 22:30, God says to Ezekiel, I searched for a man to stand in the gap, and I found none. So you may say anybody could have been a prophet, but God said, I can't find anybody to go out day after day to take the abuse of the people and to faithfully speak the words that I have put on their heart. And that must have rang inside of Jeremiah's being. Every time he thought about running, he had to ask the question, if I run, who's going to do this job? When I was a little younger, I heard a preacher say something that has stuck in my mind and heart and has anchored me from time to time. He said, when you are searching for the purpose that God has for you, when you're searching for your reason for living, when you're looking for a way to prioritize your life, the question you ought to ask yourself is this: what are the things that I'm doing now that no one can do? And if you ask that question, it'll take you to your family. Because if you're a husband, no one can be the husband to your wife right now that you are. She only has one husband. If you're a husband, you only have one wife in this moment. Of course, unless you're a nut that lives in Utah or something like that, you only have one spouse. And so you need to be the spouse that you need to be. That should be a priority in your life, because if you aren't the husband you ought to be, no one else can be the husband. I'm one of five children, and that's a little different, but not much. I'm one of only five individuals who can honor my mother and my father. I'm one of only five. If I don't do it, it's not going to get done. Who's going to step in and be the son I ought to be if I'm not the son I ought to be? If you're a parent, if you're a father today, your children only have one father, and the marriage might have ended. You might no longer be a husband to your wife. The marriage may not be fixable, but as long as your children live, they will only have one father. They may have some stepfathers. They may have some father figures, but they only have one father. And if you're not it, there are things that aren't going to get done. You are the only one who can look into their life and as a father say, I am proud of you. You are the best thing that ever happened in my life. There are things that they need emotionally that they will never get if you don't give it to them. And your responsibility is not to be happy. You're a father. Your responsibility is to be responsible. If you don't do it, who is going to do it? There are some people who will not hear the gospel unless you and I share the gospel with them. And as much as we might be even repulsed by them, there are some people in our circle of influence that won't hear the gospel unless we deliver the gospel to them. It's our duty. My dad had two stepfathers. And the first one was, again, I've shared many times to you as an audience, that he was very abusive, very domineering. He was an alcoholic and he was mean. And then when he drank, he got meaner. And my dad has memories of him wielding a shotgun and putting it in his mother's mouth and holding it there. And the kids were going nuts in the house with all this fear, with all this commotion. And that man robbed my dad of much of his childhood. But I remember as a small child, we had gone to Ohio. We were in a camp meeting and then spending some vacation time in Amish country. And Dad took a detour, and he went to see that man. And we drove down a dirt road to get to his house, and I remember the potholes. It was in the back country behind Steubenville, Ohio. And we pulled up in this yard. It really wasn't a yard. It was just a mud pit. I didn't see much grass. And there sat a very small camper. And the door of that camper was open. And beside the camper was an outhouse. It had no indoor plumbing in it. And Dad led me and my mom into that camper. The door was open, and there were two chickens sitting in that camper. And there sat this old gentleman I'd never seen before. It was this stepfather. And in that living room, my dad shared the gospel with that man. And I remember leaving, and it took many years for me to understand why we had gone to that place where a man sat, and all of the decisions in his life had brought him to this place where nobody wanted to see him. There was no running water. It was a place of misery. There he was, isolated, alone. But I think in my dad's mind, he said to himself, if I don't share the gospel with that man who robbed my childhood, who will? Who's going to go? Many years later, his second stepdad was laying on his deathbed in Arkansas, far away from the Lord. My dad drove from North Carolina to Arkansas several hundred miles to simply sit at his bed and to share the gospel with him. And all that man said to my dad was, "It's too late. What's the use now?" Those were the last words he said before he went into eternity. Awful words to say. But again, my dad said to himself, who is going to share the gospel if I don't? Will anybody in that nursing home share the gospel? Is there anybody who will care enough to go to him if I don't go? And his answer was no. No one's going to care. You and I have a duty that binds us to certain situations. It ties us to our family. It ties us to our people. It sends us to places we would not want to go, places that we dread going. But if we don't do it, who's going to do it? Jeremiah stayed with an adulterous and treacherous people because no one else would stand in the gap. If he didn't do it, who would? I think there was another reason why Jeremiah stayed, and he was immovable in that situation. And that is because it was simply the right thing to do. In Celebrate Recovery, we encourage people and we live it ourselves. We ask the question, what is the next right thing to do? Let's try to make things as uncomplicated as possible. What is the next right step? And if the first question Jeremiah asked that anchored him in his position was, if I don't do it, who's going to do it? The next question I think Jeremiah must have asked is, what is the next right thing for me to do? And the next right thing for Jeremiah to do wasn't to quit and find a cabin in the wilderness and get away from everybody. The next right thing for Jeremiah to do was always to be obedient to God and to continue to preach the gospel. In fact, there was a place in Jeremiah chapter 20 where Jeremiah essentially says, when I tried to quit, the message burned inside of me and I couldn't stop preaching. And the truth that God had continued to burn inside of him. And he says, I've got to continue to tell people the gospel. I have to continue to preach it. I have to continue to stand for what is right, because it's the next right thing for me to do. And in your situation, maybe you're facing a place where you've got to be courageous. You've got to say some things to people that they're not going to like. You've got to confront some people that don't want to be confronted. You're going to open yourself up to some physical abuse, but do it anyway. It's the next right thing to do. I had a preacher friend who was much older than I, who told me an interesting account from his ministry. He had taken a new church, and he had not been there very long till he had seen some very ungodly things happening among the leadership in that church. And he went home to his wife one day and he said, honey, I'm seeing some things that God does not want to have in this church. I can ignore them and we can stay here a long time. But if I confront them, you and I aren't going to be here very long. And his wife looked at him and she said, you've got to do what God is leading you to do. And he wasn't at that church very long. But it was the next right thing for him to do. He said, there's a right and there's a wrong, and what they're doing isn't right. And in my position, I have to tell them it's not right regardless of what they do to me. Even if they move me out of this church, I have to do the next right thing. And I think Jeremiah again was tethered to his post because he first of all asked the question, if I don't do it, who's going to do it? And secondly, what is the next right thing? And the next right thing wasn't to run away. I think there was a third thing that tethered Jeremiah to his post, and it was simply that he loved the people. He loved them. They were his family. They were an evil people, but they were his nation. And he loved his nation as much as you love your nation. He loved his kinfolk as much as you love your kinfolk. And out of love, he looked at this situation and said, I can't leave them to be destroyed. I love them too much. I have to save as many as I can in this situation. And in spite of your desire to flee, in spite of your desire to escape, love will cause you to stay far longer than you would. Simply loving them will cause you to stay. Love will cause some of you as grandparents to raise your grandchildren in your time of retirement. My little girl's 10 years old and her name's Ava. And she looked at me last week and I don't know where this came from, but she's 10 and she's a girl. Who knows where these things come from? But she looked at me and she said, Daddy, I don't think you'll ever be able to retire. And I said, why? And she said, well, because you'll have grandkids. I don't know what she meant by that. I don't know what her thinking is there. But if you're a grandparent, as much as you want to retire, and as much as you want to wring the necks of your children who won't raise their kids properly, you'll give up your retirement year because you look at those kids and you say, I love you too much. I'm your only chance right now. It seems like I'm the only one who loves you enough to live right and to make a home for you that's comfortable. And you do it simply out of love. Love will cause you to continue with your recovery. You look at the people that have to live with you. You look at your children, you look at your family, and out of love you say, I don't want you to have to live with an alcoholic. I don't want you to have to live with a person with a drug issue. I want you to live in a clean, safe place. I want you to have great memories of me, and I'm continuing with my recovery. I'm not going to relapse, even though there are times when I just want to run back to my dealer. I'm not, because when I look into your lives, love constrains me. Love will keep you in a church. I've been in churches, in my ignorance, I've looked at them and say, why is anybody in this church? This place is as dead as a doorknob. I've been in churches and there's just a few that are keeping the doors open. And I say, why don't they go somewhere else where they can get fed? But you know what? I think a lot of people stay in churches that seem to be dying because they love that place. They care about it. And they don't like what they see. They don't like what's been going on. They know that the Spirit of God isn't working there as He wants to work, but love keeps them there. Remember in Jonah chapter 4, and Jonah has ministered to Nineveh, but he got out of there about as fast as he could. He didn't stay to teach them. He didn't stay to disciple them. He just went and preached and he left. He wanted to get out of there. And he's sitting under a tree and God comes to him and says, Jonah, there's 120,000 people in that city. Should I not be concerned about them? Jonah, you're not concerned. You preached and you left. But Jonah, I love those people. I care about them. And concern from me keeps me putting grace and ministering to that city. That's why I'm still down in Nineveh while you've left. Love will keep you there. And there's something else that will keep you there when you feel like running. And that is the mercy of God in your life. The mercy of God. If the first question that Jeremiah asked was, if I leave, who's going to do this? If the second question that Jeremiah might have asked is, what's the next right thing for me to do? And that's not to run away. If the third question Jeremiah might have asked is, do I love these people? Then the fourth question Jeremiah, I think, would have asked is, how has God dealt with me in a similar situation? See, Jeremiah was a great prophet, but he was called the weeping prophet. And we call him the weeping prophet because he genuinely was touched and grieved by his people. But there was a lot in Jeremiah that was Eeyore-ish. There was a lot in Jeremiah that was pessimistic. And repeatedly in the gospel or his teaching, in the prophecies and in the narrative of Jeremiah, we find that he's looking at God and saying, why have you done this to me? Why have you left me alone? You promised me a good life and look what's become of me. And in one place he says, you tricked me. And in those moments, God came to Jeremiah and showed grace to him and loved him and treated him like a son and picked him up and dusted him off and got him going again. And see, a Christian is not a person who does unto others as we would want them to do unto us. That's the golden rule, but a Christian lives above the golden rule. We do unto others as God has done unto us. And what has God done for us? He's forgiven us. He's loved us while we were yet sinners. He's forgotten about a lot of junk in our past. He's overlooked some faults and failures in our lives. And he has blessed us because he saw we were trying and we weren't succeeding. But he saw a little energy, a little effort. And he said, I'm going to help that guy. I'm going to help that girl. He blessed us. And when we came home finally to him, he embraced us as prodigals. That's how God has dealt with us. And when you have that knowledge in your life, it tethers you. You might want to run, you might want to flee, you might want to escape, but you say, no, God didn't run from me. God didn't flee when he saw me coming, and I can't do that to other people. Listen to me. There may come a day in your life as a parent when you have raised your children just like you think God would have wanted you to. And your single daughter comes home and she says, Daddy, I'm pregnant. And everything inside of you wants to leave her sitting in the living room and go into your bedroom and shut the door and say, I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to fool with this mess. I've told her, I've taught her, and here she comes in this kind of situation. I don't want to deal with this. But if you know and you remember what God has done in your life, as a parent, you know what you're going to do? You're going to look at her and you're going to embrace her. And you're not going to put your approval on what's happened, but you're going to look at her and you're going to say, honey, I love you. And you're still one of the greatest things to ever happen in my life. And I'm here for you. You might be a Christian parent and someday you'll have to sit in the living room and you'll have a child come in and they're going to look at you and they're going to say, Daddy, I don't know who I am. I don't know if I like boys or if I like girls. I don't know who I am. I think that I might be gay. And at some point, you're going to want to run. That is not the words you want to hear. But at some point, again, in that relationship, you may have to look at that child and say, listen, honey, you know where I stand. You know where I stand. And I will never change my opinion about that behavior. I will never change. But when you come home, I don't want to argue with you. I want us to be at peace. And so when you come home, listen, you know where I stand. But I want this to be a place of love for you, because you are one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. And I love you, and my love for you is greater now than it ever has been. And you're going to have to put your arms around that daughter. You're going to have to put your arms around that son. When everything inside of you wants to run or run them out of your house, you don't want to face it. But you will be tethered to that situation because you know how God has treated you. You know, there are families that can live in the same town. They're brothers, they're sisters, and they never talk to each other. They all go to church, but they never talk to each other because of things that have happened in the past. And if you say, why are you letting this happen? This is a shame for your family to allow this kind of division to happen. They might say to you, well, you don't know what they've done to me. But the question is, do you remember what you've done to God? You may say, listen, I'm standing here, and if they want to talk to me, they can come to me. But that's not how God dealt with you. God didn't stand in heaven and say, if you want to talk to me, you climb on up here and talk to me. He sent His Son down to earth to die for you. When you remember that, you know that you got to get in that car and you got to drive across town and you got to make it right. You don't want to go over there, but you are tethered to that situation. Billy Graham passed away just a few years ago, and during his memorial service, most of his children talked, and maybe all of them, but I think the most stirring moment in that memorial service came when his daughter Ruth Graham got up and spoke for just 3 minutes about her dad. Ruth was, in many ways, the black sheep of the Graham family. She got married, and then there was a divorce. And then she met a man, and she says this during that service. You ought to go back and maybe watch it. She said she met a man at church, and he was such a handsome man. And she fell in love with him, and her mother and dad both said, honey, don't you marry that man. You don't know enough about him. She said, but I looked at my mom and dad and said, they've never been a divorced parent. They have no idea what I'm going through. And she said, on a New Year's Eve, I married that man that my dad said not to marry. And she said, less than 24 hours later, I knew it was a terrible mistake. 5 weeks later, the marriage ended. She said, I was afraid of him, that he was an abusive man. And she said, I had nowhere to go, and I called my mom and dad and asked if I could come home. And they said, come on home. She said, I went to Black Mountain, North Carolina, drove through, went to my family's house in Montreat. She said, it's set on a hill, and there's a winding driveway up the hill. And she said, I did not know what I would find at the top of that hill, because I had so, in my mind, disappointed my parents and disappointed my father and embarrassed my father publicly. She said, when I got to the top of that hill, my dad was standing in the driveway. And when I got out of the car, he came to the car and threw his arms around me and said, welcome home. Now, that's what God does for people who disappoint Him. That's what God does for people who fail Him. That's what God does for people who make big messes and hurt people and break people's heart. But in contrition, they come home and they don't know what kind of God they're going to find. But what they find is a God who comes off the porch and who meets them in the yard and throws his arms around them and says, "Welcome home. I would have still sent my son to die for you because I sent him knowing you were a sinner. While you were yet a sinner, he died for you." And that's the kind of God you and I serve. And Jeremiah knew that kind of God. And so when he looked at his situation, he not only said, "Who's going to do it if I don't? What's the right thing to do? Do I love these people?" But he could ask the question, "How has God treated me? Every time I failed him, every time I said I'm going to quit, every time I said, 'God, you've lied to me, this isn't working out,' every time I've complained about my life, God has dusted me off and picked me up and sent me on my way again. And so I can't abandon these people. As bad as they are, as much as they need a preacher, I can't leave them. I've got to stay. I've got to try to save as many as I can." In the Boston Marathon, there's 26 miles. And the Boston Marathon is one of the most famous, maybe the most famous marathon in the world. And 26 miles long, but the first 16 miles is a downhill incline, and from what I understand, that's on purpose. And so many, many people who think they're runners run the Boston Marathon, and 16 miles in, they think they're doing wonderful because it's as easy as a marathon can get. But then it begins to level off, and at mile 20 is a famous hill. And that hill is there to keep the runners who think they're runners from finishing the race oftentimes. It separates the men from the boys. And many people drop out at that hill that's been named Heartbreak Hill. And maybe today you in your life are at Heartbreak Hill. People have failed you. People have hurt you. And you've had a pretty nice life up until the last little bit. You have felt so smart. You felt so wise. Your life has been so blessed. But now you've come to Heartbreak Hill. And everybody sooner or later gets to Heartbreak Hill. When life gets hard and it gets difficult. And you want to drop out. You just want to find your cabin in the woods and stay there. But I want to tell you, if no one else will do it, if it's the right thing to do, if you love those people, and if God has shown mercy on you, you can't quit. You got to allow those issues to tether you and to anchor you in this situation that you want to run. You got to be the mate you need to be. You've got to be the parent you got to be, even though you don't want to be that parent. You've got to continue to do the ministry God has called you to do, even though it doesn't seem very fruitful, and even though there's great opposition against you now. You got to stay in the church. You got to fight the fight that God has called you to fight. You can't run. You have to stay where God has put you. The cabin in the woods can wait. But you've got to be immovable in your situation. And the God of grace, he'll come to you. And as you speak to him now and say, "Lord, I want to run, but I'm not going anywhere," I believe that he'll come and he'll give you great grace. He'll pour great mercy in your life. The Bible says that he will minister to you, and though you are weak, you won't faint. You may be running and it's getting hard, but you won't grow weary because God will strengthen you. I sat with a man yesterday, and he's saying goodbye to his wife. Doesn't want to be there. Who does? She's dying. If The doctors are right. And I know there's a part of him that just wants to get in the car and drive away, and he wishes he could get away from all the pain and all the hurt. But he can't. He stays there. He ministers to her. He loves her. And God gives him grace day by day. He'll do that for you. He's done it for me. He'll do it for you and me again. And we can depend on that. Father, I pray for those who are listening today, who are hurt, who are broken, who want, as David said, to be like a dove, to fly away. They don't want to fight. They just want to escape their situation. But you're speaking into their life and you're saying, hold on. Don't be moved. Don't flee. Don't let Satan drive you from this situation. But anchor yourself, because there is blessing yet ahead. Father, I pray that by the grace of God, they will stand and you will deliver them. In the name of Jesus Christ, it's for His glory we're asking this. Amen.